Hey everyone, I'm Chris Hall and this is the Downtime Podcast, where we take you inside the world of mountain biking. Meet the characters involved, hear their stories and find some insight to help us all get faster on our bikes. I want to take a little time to thank our supporting partners for helping me keep this podcast free for you all. First up is the Strength Factory. Ben Plenger from the Strength Factory has been on the podcast twice before. He's a super knowledgeable coach with tons of riders on his books, from everyday riders like me to world-level downhill and enduro pros, so be sure to check out those episodes. He's just released his complete MTB program. It's a monthly subscription program that covers all the bases. It will ensure you get strength, on-bike work, mobility and conditioning directly to your inbox in an easy-to-follow format every month. It's also scalable to fit your level and the amount of time that you have available to get fitter. I know that I've personally seen huge benefits from a small amount of well-targeted strength and conditioning work. So if you're interested to give it a go, then Ben has kindly offered our listeners 50% off their first month on the program, as well as a money-back guarantee if you're not satisfied. So you can give it a try for just £16. All you have to do is use the code DOWNTIMEFIT, that's DOWNTIMEFIT, all lowercase, all one word, at their checkout over on thestrengthfactory.uk. Where you will need to click on programs and then the complete MTB program, or you can follow the link in the show notes for this episode over on downtimepodcast.com. On Ben's website, you'll also find a really good set of frequently asked questions, so that'll help you understand anything you want to know about the program. All right, next up is 661, and I've been lucky to be one of the first people in the UK to get their hands on their new Reset MIPS helmet. I personally think it's the perfect helmet if you're someone that doesn't need a full face often, but does need one for the odd race, uplift day, or a big mountains trip. 661 have managed to make a light, comfortable, good-looking, and safe helmet with the new MIPS E2 system, which is designed to reduce rotational forces transmitted to your head in a crash, and they've done all this for just €160. What's more, for downtime listeners, 661 are offering 25% off the Reset MIPS helmet and the entire rest of their product range. Just head to 661.com, that's the words 661.com, and use the code DOWNTIMEPODCAST25 over on their checkout. That's DOWNTIMEPODCAST, all lowercase, and then the number 25. So a massive thanks to those guys. At this point, I really do need their support to keep this podcast going and to keep it free for you all. If you want to help support the podcast, then you can do that by heading to downtimepodcast.com/shop and grabbing yourself a t-shirt, sweatshirt, a hoodie, or a mug, and wearing it with pride. Your support doesn't have to be financial, though. Telling your friends about the podcast, sharing us over on social media, and leaving reviews on iTunes and other podcast apps goes a really long way, and I'm super grateful for everyone who's been doing that. Right, it's time for this week's guest, Rory Cunningham. We chat about his background in World Cup downhill, dealing with some pretty serious injuries, switching to EWS, and some great insight into what he's learned from being a mountain bike coach. So without further ado, here's Rory Cunningham. Rory Cunningham, welcome to the Downtime Podcast. Thanks for taking some time out this evening for a chat.
Yeah, good to finally get on here.
Yeah, good stuff. Yeah, we managed to get together for a bit of a ride as part of the Kendal Mountain Festival, didn't we? Back end of last year. And then I had to reschedule on you, so sorry about that.
Yeah, no worries. Christmas is a busy time of year, so.
Well, yeah, it was my 40th birthday, and my wife very kindly booked a surprise trip away. But didn't tell me about it, obviously, otherwise that ruins the surprise. But yeah, there you go. All good in the end.
Yeah.
Cool. So as we start a lot of these off, let's wind back the clock a bit. Am I right in thinking you were quite into rugby at a young age?
Yeah. I guess growing up in the Scottish Borders, it was kind of like the thing to do when you're younger. So I started playing rugby pretty young. And that was kind of the first thing I was really passionate about, and then got a mountain bike for Christmas when I was about 10 or 11 years old, and then started to kind of juggle the two, and then I was kind of playing rugby on the Saturday and then mountain bike on the Sunday, and then it kind of started to switch. And when I started to race and was required to go away for like weekends, it kind of took over, and never looked back.
Awesome. Were you kind of into the gravity side of mountain biking right from the start, or was it more of a kind of cross country, like exploring on a bike sort of thing?
It's difficult to say, to be honest. I think like a lot of kids, I just got a bike and the first thing I wanted to do was go fast downhill and send it off jumps. And I think that's where a lot of my skill came from. Like I grew up in the countryside and I kind of had a set of rugby posts in the front garden, and just fields and woods and whatever surrounding the house. So there was no tarmac, so I never got kind of sucked into any of the fads like scooters or skateboarding or anything like that. And yeah, I just started out kind of building jumps and, you know, think like everybody does, like a plank of wood and a brick. And then suddenly it was, you know, two bricks and a plank of wood, and then three bricks, and then two planks of wood, you know, and then three bricks, and then six bricks to make it even bigger. And then it got to that point, and my dad actually built me a jump out of wood, a big wooden kicker, and then built a landing, and then just made it further and further apart, and then rode that until it structurally kind of fell apart, and I ended up jumping it and going through the landing and having a bit over the bars, and my bike was still stuck in it, which was pretty funny. But yeah, that was the start of it.
Sweet, nice one. And yeah, how long before you got into the racing side of things? What kind of age were you when you started dabbling with that?
I probably started kind of riding a lot when I was about 10 or 11, and then I did my first race when I was 13. And there was a guy a couple of years older than me at school called Dave Young, who he went to Junior Worlds, I think, in Leger in 2004, came fifth. So he was like a really handy rider, and he was a bit of a role model to me when I was younger. And although he didn't give me many compliments, he said, "I think you're pretty. Yeah, I think you're all right. You're probably good enough to race." Did my first race in juvenile, came third. And then, yeah, from there, it was kind of just a snowball. I just loved it and wanted to do it more often. And, you know, a year later, I was kind of traveling the length of Britain, doing my first, it was MPS back then, with my mum in a little trailer, just driving me around. And yeah, it was the start of it.
So was there some obvious natural talent there from the start, or did you have to work hard at it to get the results?
I think like I grew up riding, kind of being the one that was always kind of asked to test stuff. So I kind of probably had more, more confidence than I did talent. I was kind of like, yeah, we've built a jump, Rudy, you try it out. And yeah, so I was kind of never really that intimidated by anything. I was always quite confident, and I definitely wasn't as kind of talented as like Josh when I was racing against him, but I probably was a little bit more determined at times. So okay. I think that went a long way.
Yeah, a fearlessness helps in that sport for sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And how did you approach kind of getting into a team at that time? Because things were very different, really. Like social media was kind of just getting going, I suppose. Definitely not at the level it's at now. Was it hard to find a team, hard to get kind of support and sponsorship?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of rode for local bike shops. So I rode for Bike Sport, which is now, I guess, iCycles in Ayrleithan, and Bike Love, a shop in Glasgow. And I rode for kind of both of them right up through my kind of youth and junior years. I mean, like I won Junior Worlds on a bike that my parents bought me, sponsored by a bike shop, which these days is unheard of. You know, I mean, kids are getting picked up when they're 16 by teams. But, you know, back then there wasn't, like you say, there wasn't social media, and I didn't really have, when I got to kind of 16, 17, and started kind of really, I guess, making a name for myself. You know, I had Chris Ball kind of help me out at that point, but didn't have the kind of support or the role model that Josh had with Steve. And but at the same time, I think it kind of made me want it more. Seeing, you know, him be in Santa Cruz as a junior, and you know, me, I was riding an iron horse and cutting my sleeves off and trying to be Sam Hill. So it was definitely motivating for me to see that. And then when I won Junior Worlds, joined Chain Reaction Cycles, and that was like the first real sponsorship I had. So
yeah, tell us a bit about that victory. That was that Fort William?
Yeah.
That must have felt pretty good, winning that in your kind of home country.
Yeah, it was pretty special. Looking back on it, I think a lot of people weren't. I mean, I was really confident I could win. That was the funny thing, is I didn't go into it as like a random that was had, you know, like an outside chance. Like I went into it leading the Junior World Cup, I'd kind of had a string of top 20s as a junior in the elite field. Mm-hmm. And, you know, everything I was doing with Chris and Scottish Cycling at the time was kind of leading towards peaking at that event. And, yeah, we got it done.
Yeah. And what a good reaction from the crowd. It must be a pretty intense place to win being a Scot.
Yeah, it was. It's funny looking back, like being in the centre of the kind of finish arena and everybody around you, it's a really different perspective than being on the outside looking in. So when I crossed the line, it was just mad, and I didn't know, you know, if I'd won until I'd turned around and, you know, checked and double checked the board. So, yeah, it was a relief more than anything. There was quite a lot of pressure that I definitely put myself, as in if I didn't walk away from that race with the jersey, then I was going to be disappointed. So it was, yeah, probably the best part of 2 years kind of aiming for that race. And yeah, kind of was the stepping stone for my professional career.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, you must have been feeling on top of the world after that. But it wasn't long after that you had a bit of a crash or something where you damaged your knee. Is that right?
Yeah, so following Fort William, I think it was a couple of months after, I was just down in the valley just riding and just awkwardly kind of slipped just before a compression, put my foot out and just twisted my knee, and I felt like a big pop. And then I kind of fell again, like kind of from height onto the knee. I'd effectively just injured, outstretched. And yeah, it was kind of like my first real injury. That kind of dragged on a bit. It got misdiagnosed, and then they were kind of, you've maybe sprained this, maybe sprained that, and got back into riding. And then, you know, a few months later, it just gave way on me again. And after we had some scans, whatever, I'd basically fully ruptured my ACL, partially ruptured my MCL, torn the meniscus. I'd put a dent in the cartilage because of the impact from falling on it. And it was a real mess. And I found this out in January, and I was expected to race for Chain Reaction in April. So kind of made the decision to just try and build as much strength into it as I could in the time I had and go racing in 2008. And it was, you know, in hindsight, it was a pretty silly decision. I should have just, with an injury kind of that big, I should have just got it done and taken the time. But yeah, it was definitely a difficult couple of years that followed that, just with I was kind of playing catch up and had, you know, effectively two off seasons where I didn't touch a bike because I was just trying to rehab my knee. So yeah, complicated, but you know, we got through it.
Yeah, and the first time on a kind of big team, I suppose, did that add a pressure almost at the wrong time, kind of trying to come back from injury and feeling that pressure to perform?
Yeah, I think it was difficult. I mean, they were pretty good as far as they knew I was coming back from injury, and they didn't pile a load of pressure on me. And you know, Nigel Page, anybody that knows him, he's a really cool, genuine guy, and he kind of understood, and he'd been through kind of a big injury with his ankle a few years kind of before that, so he kind of understood what I was going through. But it was difficult, you know, trying to make that transition to elite. New bike, new team, new teammates, and then obviously trying to work through an injury that was quite quite tricky to manage throughout the season. It was a lot kind of to deal with in my kind of first year professional. But you know, it's one of these things, you play the hand you're dealt.
Yeah, for sure. Came through it as well, and sort of continued to climb your way up the elite ranks through a couple of teams. Through, was it like a Maxxis Rocky Mountain team?
Yeah, so I did 3 years with CRC, and I'm not gonna lie, it was a test in 3 years. Every kind of off season, I felt like I'd done the right thing, and I just wasn't getting the results. And you know, it was a combination of, you know, going too fast and crashing when I was on for a good result, or just not going too slowly. And it was a difficult time, and I was kind of going around in circles a bit as to what I needed to do. And then when I ultimately, when I left CRC and my contract wasn't renewed, it was definitely a moment of kind of, there was a sense of urgency, as in like, we need to get my shit in a pile here. And had a kind of last minute deal with Maxis Rocky Mountain come up, and then 2011 was actually a really good year for me and a big step in the right direction. I got kind of consistent top 20s in World Cups, won national champs, and just had a string of kind of consistent results, which was really good.
Yeah, what do you think kind of clicked in that season then to help you get that consistency? Is it like finding your pace, getting something right in that, or are there other things going on?
I think it was a combination of a few things. Like we spoke about earlier, like I don't ever feel like I've had the most natural talent, as in I've always been pretty confident, but growing up, like I remember watching, like I kind of grew up the year between Josh and Brendan, who are arguably like two of the most, or people will say are two of the most naturally talented riders, even today. Yeah. And just the amount of time, what they could do on bikes back even when they were youth and junior, it was like, I couldn't do any of that. And then, I guess as I started to, when I started to transition into elite, I figured that the piece of the puzzle I was missing was training. And I, although I do think that is very important, I'd honestly had like quite a big skill deficit in comparison to where I wanted to be. Mm-hmm. And one of the biggest things that I did, kind of around the 2010, 2011, kind of time was buy a BMX and go to the skate park. And that single-handedly like transformed my riding in the space of 6 months. Just the volume of time on the bike, just timing and, having to be precise and just bike skill. And I wasn't kind of consciously going out and trying to learn. I was just going to the skate park and trying new things. And yeah, in the space of kind of 6 months, I went from being, I would say pretty average at that kind of stuff to actually pretty good. And I think that combined with a bike I liked with Maxis Rocky Mountain and some kind of good training under my belt, I just had a bit of confidence, and I didn't feel like I was having to risk as much to get results. I feel like I could kind of just be a little bit more composed in racing and take my time a little bit, and then the results were pretty steady. So I think it was a combination of a lot of things.
Yeah, but that's interesting that the BMX skill you feel really kind of transferred across to enabling speed, kind of almost safer on the downhill bike.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's funny, like I do quite a bit of coaching, or I've done quite a bit of coaching over the years. I've raced just to kind of supplement my salary in the off season, and I think it's quite funny that mountain biking, it seems like riders they come out of junior into elite and everybody just talks training, and I think skill is something that, or just going out and practicing is something that is never really talked about. If you look at other sports, for example, rugby, like the All Blacks still do a huge amount of, skill-based drills, and, they're always trying to improve that side of their game. Whereas I think a lot of riders make that transition into elite and they think that 100% of the difference is going to be just putting the hours in on the road bike and in the gym and stuff. And although that does have a big part of it, I do think that, you can keep improving your skill set and keep getting better as a rider by focusing on just little weaknesses or places you need to work at within your skill set. So that's something I've definitely tried to continue to do, because I noticed such a big improvement with myself. Back like 2010, 11.
Yeah. So was that quite a conscious thing from you to kind of address a weakness that you felt you had, or was it just a coincidence that you happened to get a BMX and things started to click?
It was actually Chris Ball kind of said to me, like, you should get a BMX and ride in the winter. And he didn't exactly say you should get a BMX and ride in the winter because it will make you a much better rider. He just kind of planted the seed. And then, anybody that's experienced a winter in Scotland, it's much nicer to be indoors where it's warm and riding BMX than so having some lights on pedaling up a fire road that's like minus 12. So that definitely seemed like a more attractive training method to me at the time. And yeah, I think just like I said, I didn't consciously do it to try and get better. It just kind of happened with the repetition and, you know, the amount of time. So if you go to the skate park for 2 hours, you probably ride an hour of that. If you go to a local uplift day and do 10 runs, you probably get half an hour. So if I was going to the skate park 2-3 nights a week, I was getting like 3 hours of proper skill-based practice that otherwise I probably wouldn't have had. So it's kind of a, you can see how it pays off, even if you aren't consciously trying to get better. It just, that repetition over time, just, it adds up.
Yeah, yeah. It seems to be working for Cade Edwards, so.
Yeah, so. He's too talented for his own good.
He's pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah, cool. And so then you kind of moved from Rocky Mountain onto, was it Alpine Bikes after that?
Yeah, so Rocky Mountain actually folded at the end of 2011, which kind of left me a bit, like, I've kind of hung out to dry a little bit there, especially after a kind of a good year. It was back to the drawing board, and I was kind of rushing around last minute trying to put something together. And Alpine Bikes supported me with a trek and pretty much got myself to the races in 2012, which was not ideal, but you know, we made it happen and didn't have the season I wanted, but got enough results to kind of prove that I was kind of worthy of a team. And at the end of 2012, so beginning of 2013, I joined Junior and then stayed with them for 4 years, I believe.
Yeah, yeah, you had a good run with those guys. And with Reese on the team as well at some point?
Yeah, Reese kind of, so it's probably about the time I joined Junior that me and Reese crossed paths for the first time. So I listened to his podcast and it's quite funny hearing him talk about it. But yeah, it was a funny time. So like he said, I had this motocross bike that was an absolute dog of a thing and it just wouldn't start. It was like trying to start, it was like trying to split the atom. In fact, it was probably harder than that because we know how to split the atom. Like, we couldn't start this thing. And Reese's dad's like, he's an absolute legend, but he's kind of like the local practical handyman. As in, if you need something fixed or need something done that's remotely mechanical or metal based or anything, he's your guy. Like, you go to Will. And so I took it to him, and you know, I think to this day it's probably the only mechanical device he hasn't been able to solve or wow. fix. It was yeah, it was pretty, yeah, he probably still has nightmares about it, to be honest. But yeah, so that kind of got me and Reese, that's how we met. And then I think his dad had a crash and was kind of injured, and Reese was just coming back from breaking his leg. And I remember, I think I started taking, I'd go and pick Reese up kind of every Sunday and we'd go and ride motocross together. And that was kind of how we got introduced. And then from there, he kind of, I guess, got a mountain bike and then started just effectively doing what I used to do, which was just build a jump and send it off it. And at this point, Facebook existed. So I was getting tagged in like all these photos of Reese. He was just tagging me, like, yeah, just sending jumps in his kind of local village. And all my friends were like, who's this weird, like, Reese kid tagging in all these photos, like doing these big goon whips or whatever. And I thought it was pretty funny. And then he started racing and was pretty good. And I think it was probably the end of that year, so end of probably 2012, 13, I kind of went riding with him for the first time. And what he lacked in skill, he made up for in enthusiasm and entertainment. So it was pretty funny, man. Like, he had so much confidence and so much speed, but absolutely no clue what to do with it. And yeah, it was like from there I saw something in him and was kind of like, oh, he's got something. And the next year I was running some junior development days for Scottish Cycling, And I kind of like brought Reese along just, I mean, for entertainment value, if nothing else.
Yeah.
And straight away, like it was brilliant for him because he was riding with kind of the fastest guys in Scotland his own age. And, you know, they were kind of like, nobody knew who he was. And I'd just kind of, you know, come to work with Uncle Rory Day kind of thing. And straight away it was like, he was kind of holding his own but with absolutely kind of no experience of racing. And, you know, with Brace, it was funny. Like, he was from the get go, he had almost like what I would say was like the most complicated piece of the puzzle already sorted. As in, there's so many good young riders who are fit and they've got like a really good skill set. And it's like getting that top end speed and confidence is so tricky. As in, like, it's kind of, you build that over time. Right. Whereas Brace had that straight away. And it was almost just teaching him how to ride a bike. And, you know, when we started, like, he effectively thought like pedaling was, you know, the transition of like a throttle in motocross. And, you know, motocross, right, is like, if you're not on the gas, you're on the brakes. And you could see that in his riding. And he was just trying to like pedal through rock gardens. And, you know, I was just, you know, kind of half watching it through my hands, thinking, oh God, he's like, I brought this kid along and he's just yard sailing everywhere. But as soon as I started to break that down and get him to understand the concept of like carrying speed and braking early and exiting corners faster than the end and stuff, like, he just came on so quickly. And it's funny, like, now what then was kind of his weakness, what was holding him back, now is probably one of his best strengths. Like, if you look at his bottom splits from Fort William last year, I think he was fastest or second fastest on that kind of flat, awkward, kind of lower section before the motorway, where you need, yeah, to carry speed and pump, and you can't really pedal for any length of time. It's just the odd pedal stroke. And it's like, that's something he's consciously gone and worked on, and now he's one of the best in the world at it. So it's like, you know, and that's within what, three or four years. And it's pretty amazing to see. But he came a long way in a short period of time. And it was an entertaining journey, we'll say that.
Awesome. Yeah, it must have been fun to have him on Unior together. But that was it, Unior, when you first dabbled in a couple of EWS races?
Yeah, so I did my first EWS. It was like a local one in the Tweed Valley was it 2014?
Yeah, the Glen Trust one.
Yeah, so I did that, and I didn't actually have a trail bike at the time, so I borrowed a local hire bike from Alpine and just put a few bits on it and thought, we'll give it a crack, and then ended up winning the second stage.
Yeah.
And I can't remember, I think I was in the top 20, but...
Yeah, 16th overall.
Yeah, so it wasn't...
It's all right on a borrowed bike, isn't it? It
wasn't a bad first showing, but... Yeah, it was pretty funny. Like, I guess I went into it a little bit kind of, just open-minded and thought, we'll see how it goes. And yeah, it was all right. But it was one of these things. I did the one the year after and I think I came fifth. And it was, even then, like, I knew if I wanted to do it or wanted to be competitive, I would need to, you know, do a lot more, like a lot longer riding and really switch things up a bit. And at that point I was actually riding pretty well in downhill, and I guess hadn't thought about it, but hadn't made any inroads into actually making a switch.
Yeah. So the focus was still fully downhill at that point. It was just a bit of fun. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it was, you know, a local event, and Unior were pretty keen for me to do it. And it kind of seemed like a bit of a shame not to do it, if you know what I mean, because it was an international event in your backyard effectively was a bit of a no-brainer to lace up and get out there
for sure. And then end of 2016, was it, you signed for the Canyon Factory team?
Yeah, so 2016 was a pretty good year for me, and I guess halfway through that season I'd spoken to Canyon, and they were kind of keen for me to, you know, to join if I could kind of prove my worth effectively. And then I think like 2 weeks after I had a chat with them, I got ninth in Lenzerheide. And that was, I guess, the kind of proof that they needed. And yeah, signed with them at the end of 2016 and was, yeah, I guess pretty excited about the whole thing. And then unfortunately kind of had a string of shoulder problems that, yeah, took me out of 2017 entirely.
Yeah, literally the whole season, no downhill racing at all. Was that what happened?
Yeah, so I had what was meant to be a routine little shoulder cleanup at the end of 2016, so it would be November 2016. And it was a bit of a strange one because I'd been giving me issues all year, and I'd had a few different scans trying to pinpoint what was wrong. And I ended up getting an MRI arthrogram, which is where they inject like dye into the joint. Mm-hmm. And then if they can see the dye leaking out of the joint capsule, they know there's a tear, which it's quite an interesting experience because they've got this like massive needle that they just have like lodged in your shoulder. And then in order to get the dye in, they usually have to like X-ray it. So you'll be like lying with this, like a cartoon sized needle sticking out your shoulder full of dye, and they'll take an X-ray and then they'll go, oh, no, we're not quite there yet. And then they'll like fiddle around with it, push it in a little bit further, back to the X-ray table, another kind of, you know, another image, oh, a little bit more. And then, so that was kind of an experience, but they got results back.
Sounds from horrible.
That. Oh, mate, that's nothing in comparison to what came next.
All right, carry on.
So they got the results back from that, and there was a small tear posteriorly, which at the back of the shoulder. And they were like, yeah, we think, you know, a small keyhole surgery, we can stitch up the labrum, the posterior labrum, and, you know, 3 months, you'll be back to what you want to do. And I guess I'd worked so hard to get to the point where I had an opportunity like the one I had with Canyon that I didn't really want to leave anything on the table. Like I knew it was holding me back in 2016, and I thought, no, I need to get this repaired and get it sorted. And so, you know, there's no ifs and buts. Like it's going to be sorted. And about 2 or 3 months into the recovery, I just, like, my shoulder was, when it was meant to be kind of, I guess, starting to feel good, it was feeling a lot worse than it had pre-op. And I couldn't really pinpoint what it was. I'd done everything right, and I was getting a bit kind of frustrated because we were obviously about February at this point and getting close to the start of the season. And I had more scans and more poking and prodding by surgeons. And I had another scan, and it ultimately revealed that the bone at my glenoid, which is like your shoulder socket, the bone at the back had effectively worn away, like it had just worn flat. And I guess that when the surgeons who'd done the initial operation had probably been looking for what they wanted to see, as in like a cartilage tear, uh-huh, and hadn't really fully assessed it, and had maybe overlooked the fact that there was actually a bit of wear with the bone, and was kind of faced with a bit of a tricky situation because I had two options at that point. The first option was to try and rehab, you know, continue what I'd been doing and hope that it would come good. Mm. And the second option was a surgery called a posterior bone block, which is where they take bone off your hip and rebuild the back of the shoulder, the glenoid, so the back of the shoulder socket, to effectively give it stability. But they have to cut the whole posterior cartilage out as well. So it clinically doesn't have the best results in general, never mind like returning to professional sport.
Yeah.
And it was a pretty, you know, something I guess wasn't really expecting, and took me back a little bit. And I was kind of went back and talked to my parents, and I was like, I don't know what to do. And they were like, well, you know, go see somebody else, get a second opinion. So I went down to Manchester, and with the help of Darren Roberts from Red Bull, got an appointment with a guy called Len Funk.
<Believe me. laughs> Awesome.
who's I guess one of the world's best shoulder surgeons, and came into his office, and you know, he's kind of got my scan there, and he's like, oh, you know, it doesn't look good. And then he basically was in the room and abducted my arm, so kind of took my humerus, or like my upper arm, like level with my shoulder, and rotated it, and then just kind of was like, give me the weight of your arm, and just pulled my shoulder out, like straight out the back in the kind of consultation room. And then I heard everybody in the room kind of go and then he just kind of like just pushed it forward and back in and went, yeah, this isn't good. And I guess long story short, as he said, you've got two options. You've got, you know, you try and manage it like that, which he said I can tell he's not going to work with how unstable it is, or you get this operation. And he said, but let me tell you, like, your shoulder will never be normal again. And he said, like, I can't remember the words exactly, but he pretty much said I would start thinking about a career after racing.
Wow.
And you know, this is, you know, 2 months before I'm meant to have my first race with Canyon. And he said, if you want me to go ahead with the operation, like, it's like a 5 or 6 hour operation, and I think for him to do it was going to be like something like $8,000 or $10,000, which I didn't have. And you know, it was a long drive back to Scotland after that.
I bet.
And and then I went back, spoke to my parents again, and you know, the guy in Edinburgh who was effectively doing it through the NHS was kind of saying, you know, the same thing. You know, clinically it doesn't have the best success rate, and especially not in returning to professional sport. But at that point I didn't really have an option, so I had to wait like 2 months just to get the operation, which was like the longest 2 months ever. And then I think April 2017 got the operation done. And it was pretty brutal. I don't think harvesting bone from your hip is ever graceful, but I got like a big like 6-inch incision on my left hip, and then like a 6-inch incision right down the back of my left shoulder. I still don't have any feeling in my kind of upper leg from where they took the graft down there.
Right.
And for a long time, my shoulder was just seemed to be pretty stagnant. And no matter what I did, I just couldn't build stability into it. And I guess about the end of the year, I was, you know, Canyon had kind of offered me a ride, but it was a bit of a, you know, we'll honor our agreement from this year, but it was kind of, you know, I wasn't getting to all the races, and you know, my salary had been significantly reduced. And anyway, at that point, because I hadn't raced, I didn't have any UCI points, so that was going to be another issue racing World Cups for the next year. And it was just a bit lost. And then I'd kind of got back to riding just kind of 70-80%, and was riding with Mark Scott a lot, because he'd finished his the Enduro series. And then I got the call off Trek kind of last minute, pretty much the day before I was going to re-sign with Canyon, saying, what are you doing next year? And I was like, well, probably going to race Dino for Canyon. Why? And they're like, oh, do you want to join the factory Enduro team? And I mulled it over for a couple of days, and it was a funny situation. Like, part of me still wanted to stay in downhill, and I wasn't sure about going to Enduro, because I knew things would have to change. Like, I knew I'd have to change my training and really approach things differently. But what kind of swung it for me was, like, Trek came to the table and were really positive about it, and were kind of like, if you can prove to us that you're medically fit, you know, we believe in you, because you've already proved to us how good you are.
Yeah.
Whereas on the other hand, I kind of had, you know, Canyon being like, well, we'll kind of make room for you, but, you know, you're not getting all the races. And it was two totally different approaches. And I felt like one team wanted me, and one team were kind of like making room for me. and that ultimately swung my decision. And yeah, signed for Trek, and then had to go through the process of finding a surgeon who would say that I was medically fit to race, which was also pretty complicated, because as soon as you tell somebody you've had a posterior bone block, they're like, not so sure about that. Yeah. So in one way or another, I managed to get somebody to say, oh, the shoulder's stable, he'll be fine. And then, yeah, and then 2018 came round and we cracked on.
Sweet. Yeah, do you know what made Trek come your way? Because obviously you weren't you know, known for your enduro racing at that point in time. You'd obviously shown your hand and shown you had capability, but do you know why they came after you?
I'd kind of spoke to Chris Ball and asked him like what teams maybe looking for a rider, and I'd contacted Trek and kind of hadn't really heard anything back. And then I know Katie went in pretty well, and she was kind of saying, oh, because Lewis was on the team in 2017, and she was kind of saying, oh, I don't know if Lewis is gonna stay or if he's gonna go. And then I think ultimately Lewis signed with Ibis and a spot opened up. And I mean, we're talking kind of like middle of November when it actually came to the table. So I think they were kind of I guess they didn't have really many options, and you know, I certainly didn't really have any options. So I think it was kind of like a last minute thing, and it was kind of a blessing in disguise, really.
Yeah, cool. So that came along, and obviously you say that was towards the end of the year. It gives you a whole off season to effectively switch disciplines, right? I mean, it's a pretty big change downhill to enduro, yeah?
Yeah. Certainly made me kind of, it forced me to change my training, you know. Just being able to do kind of 6-7 hours on the bike, like 2-3 days in a row is something I wasn't used to. And at the same time, like I was riding a lot with Mark and with Mark Scott and Katie. And so I kind of, I wouldn't say was totally, I had an idea of what I needed to do. And then when Mark, at the end of that year, Mark switched trainers, and he ended up working with Jimmy, who I'd worked with. And it was like suddenly this really, really good little kind of training group that we had. It's something like, it's funny, I look back at like when I trained for downhill, and it's something I'd probably missed, as in just having somebody to ride with kind of every day. And we've got, you know, now we've got a really, really close group. There's like four of us in the Tweed Valley who are all just mad for it. Like me and Mark obviously race professionally, but there's two other guys, Gaz Neal and Gregor Frew, and they both work offshore, so it's like when they're home they're pretty much training like professional athletes, and then they go away and work on the regs and then come home and repeat. And there's always somebody to kind of keep you on your toes and go riding with, and it's been really, really refreshing. And although the training's been challenging, as it's kind of forced me to do things differently, it's been really rewarding and also really fun. So it's been refreshing.
Cool. And yeah, how have you enjoyed your first full season on the EWS circuit?
It's been cool, man. I think it's definitely cool to go places, like go to new venues and get to see different parts of the world. I think that's one thing about enduro that is really attractive, as in, you know, the venues kind of change year on year, and you do have like the staple ones like Finale and Whistler and the ones you kind of revisit regularly. But you know, getting to go to South America and see Colombia and Chile, and then, you know, this year going to New Zealand and Tasmania, like it's exciting to get to go to all these new places and, you know, have half a dozen or more kind of new trails to ride at each one of those venues. It's really cool, and definitely refreshing.
Yeah. And any surprises? Was there anything kind of that caught you out this season?
To be honest with you, I went into it with quite open-minded, and I didn't go in with any preconceptions of what it was going to be like, as I kind of just took it race by race. And each race can be so different as well. Like Colombia was, you know, there wasn't a stage probably over 4 minutes, and it was just an absolute mud bath. And then you go to Latuil, and there's not a stage less than like 8 minutes, and you know you get halfway and you're just hanging on. And yeah, it was all kind of new to me. And I guess being pretty open-minded and kind of just, you know, preparing as best you could and taking something from each race and learning and trying to put that into kind of motion for the next one was pretty cool. And I feel like I've learned a lot. And you know, I was kind of happy with my year. I feel as my first kind of proper go at it, it went well. And but at the same time, I feel like I have a lot to improve on, and there's a lot I've been working on. And you know, I'm excited for this year as well.
Awesome. Yeah, what are kind of the biggest learnings for you then from this season?
I mean, all I've got to compare it to is downhill, right? So it's quite funny. Like in downhill, when you race, when as soon as you're against the clock in a race run, you know the track so well that you know every single root rock, you know, on the whole course. And in your head, it's like, or mentally, you already know how something should feel before you get there. As in, you're kind of leaning into corners already kind of, you know, thinking about the next one, because it's, you know, the track changes. Yeah, like it does, you know, it roughs up for a race and it can get dry or wet or whatever, but you know it so well that you can almost, you know, you can almost commit to stuff before you're there.
Yeah.
Whereas with enduro, you know, there were certainly points this year where that caught up with me, is and I would start to ride too committed and then would get lost and would be like, you know, where am I on a stage? Or you'd come around and be like, I forgot about that corner, and you'd kind of like, you know, overshot it or whatever. So I think it's like you have to ride a little bit like more reserved and ride more what's in front of you rather than committing fully to what you kind of in your head is coming up. Uh-huh. But it's equally as challenging, man. Like downhill, obviously, that you're pushing the absolute limits of speed and grip and, you know, how fast you can process the trail. And enduro's similar, but it's almost, there's more to process as far as, because you don't know where you're going. Or it's not that you don't know where you're going, but you don't know the track. It's impossible to know, you know, 8 stages that are 8 minutes long, every root and rock. You kind of have to just pick the important bits and then be a little bit more reserved on the bits that are tricky or you don't know as well. And that definitely, like balancing that out definitely took a while, but I feel like the end of the year I was starting to really understand that and having the ability to actually kind of back off in a race run to do something cleanly rather than just trying to like hammer through it as you would in downhill. So I think that pacing aspect's definitely difficult to switch, but I feel like we're getting there.
Cool. And have you changed much in your training this off season compared to last off season, now you've got that full season of experience?
Yeah, a bit. I think I wouldn't say I've changed anything dramatically. I think it's more refinement than anything else. Spending a lot more time on the mountain bike than on the road bike, which is good. I think, you know, road definitely has its place, but I think, you know, maybe last year I'd relied a little bit too much on it for the kind of base miles. And then, you know, mountain biking is just, it's a lot more savage. Like the climbs are steeper and it's more inconsistent. And, you know, at the end of the day, like just the, you know, if you ride up, you've got to ride down. So you get a lot more, you know, bike time in a, you know, the racing environment, if you will. So we've done a lot more bike stuff, a little bit more gym stuff. Just because I think last year, like there was definitely races where I was fatiguing due to just like not having the strength rather than not having the like aerobic capacity. Like the race at Latuil was just, it was savage. Like I cannot describe how savage it was. It's like riding Fort William, like back to back on a trail bike 8 times. It was just so difficult, and you'd get halfway or two thirds down a stage and you almost lose the control, you lose the ability to ride a bike. There was points, wow. There was points of that race where the bike was riding me, no doubt. And I got to the bottom, was thinking, this is like, I can't do this, but you know, everybody else is in the same boat. So it's, you know, some people do kind of, you know, like Sam's ability to maintain that composure and that form on the long stages is pretty incredible. But, you know, there's a lot of people, or there was a lot of people, including myself included, that were, hanging by a thread at the end.
That's good though. It's taking people to the edge, I guess. So
yeah, exactly. I mean, it's, you know, it's the Enduro World Series. It should be pushing the limits of the sport and, kind of forcing us all to get better and improve.
For sure. Yeah. And some good results in there. Fourth place in Pettsen. Gotta be pretty happy with that, because that looked like a hard weekend.
Yeah, that was a good weekend. It was a strange race. It was, a lot of the tracks were really fresh and wasn't very high speed, but just very technical, quite steep, really kind of soft, and the terrain was changing a lot. Like, because the tracks were so fresh, you'd come into a corner that a day previous was a big banked kind of berm, and it'd be 6 foot down the hill and would just go straight into a tree. So you had to be on your toes. And it was funny, like I didn't feel like the race went as well as the result was, if you know what I mean. But you know, I think it just was a combination of just being smooth, and there was, I dare to think how many corners there were in that race, like thousands of corners, and they were all just kind of soft ruts and off cambers, and you know, I kind of love that stuff. So I did really enjoy the ride in there, and I think that probably reflected in the result.
Yeah, it sounds like a fun weekend. And then Ainsa is the race that I think you're most famous for from this season, due to your rather interesting wheel. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, so Ainsa was a bit of a dull one, really. I mean, it was kind of a quite peddly, flat, kind of rocky race, to be honest. It was, which, if you'd asked me, if you'd asked me before the race, I'd say it was the exact opposite of what my strengths would be. But I think the first stage I was ninth, and the second stage I was sixth, which was, you know, I was definitely surprised by that, but I felt like I was riding well. And then kind of the top of the third stage, there was a little blind rocky crest, and I just picked up, like, to kind of get over it, to just almost pre-jump it. And there must have been a really sharp rock on the other side that I didn't know was there. So when I pushed into the back of it, the tire just went flat straight away. And then had to race like another three or four minutes on that stage. And with the terrain being so rocky and so dry and hard, you know, the tire came off the rim, and then it got wrapped around the wheel, and then I ended up riding the last kind of 30 seconds or so just, you know, with the back wheel completely locked because the tire was kind of wedged down through the chainstays and stuff. So got to the bottom of that stage, and my wheel was just trashed. Like, I was just, I kind of at that point was like, well, that's my race done. But I was like, well, if I can get to the next transition, which was actually, you know, every other transition to that point had been super long and really easy. And then stage 3 to 4 to finish the day was like 20 minutes. So I didn't even really have time to try and properly repair it. So I just like took the wheel out, put the tire on my shoulders, and then just rode to the next stage on the rim. And yeah, it was quite funny. Like, there was all the crowd kind of walking out the stage, and I sounded like a shopping trolley with this like bare rim, just like down the tarmac road. And they got to the next stage, and I had a tube, and I was like, well, I've got to try and fix it. And it was quite funny, actually. There was like this moment where all the riders that had kind of, that were at the start waiting to go, all kind of donated. It was like this ritual where they all donated their zip ties to help me try and zip tie the tire back onto the wheel, because the rim was so damaged, like there's no way it would stay on and seated. So managed to kind of nurse it the majority of the way through that stage, with it kind of, I guess there was bits of tube poking out and zip ties. I didn't have time to cut any of the zip ties, so it sounded like one of those, you know, those wheels that kids have, like those things that move up and down the spokes. And
make, oh, yeah, like spokey dokies.
Yeah. So it sounded like that with all the zip ties going through my chainstay. And then it was quite funny. It came off the rim on the last straight as I crossed the line, and then I went through the beam as it was like wedging to a stop, and then the tube just went boom. which was much to the entertainment of the crowd, and I was firmly over it by that point, I'm not gonna lie. So wheel off again, tire off again, and then just rode it out on the rim. And then I didn't know if I was gonna, it was quite a long transition back to the race venue, so I didn't know if I was gonna make it. And then pretty much every rider around me helped in some way, whether it's pushing me, or I think Greg Callahan put a tube around his seat post and I held on to that and made it back. And then kind of, I guess, yeah, thought, well, we'll put a new rim on tomorrow and we'll start. But that's kind of, that's it kind of
thing. Yeah, it's a big penalty for changing a wheel, yeah?
Yeah, I think it's 5 minutes for a rim.
Right.
So,
yeah,
you know, I didn't see how they were going to salvage it. But, yeah, the man, Tyler West, somehow made it happen. I think he had a set of, went into the basement of the place we were staying, and there was like a set of clippers for used for like horse, like trimming horses' hoofs or something like that. And he managed to use them and unbend all the dings. And the rim was actually pretty straight, but they're just every edge, like the both sides were either caved in or bent out. And he managed to straighten it all up, put a tube in, put a FTD in, glued it to the rim, put about a liter of sealant in it, and was like, right, you've got to run it super hard and let's just hope it lasts. And amazingly, it did.
How did the bike feel though? Because that was it, like 6 or 7 kilos or something, that wheel?
Yeah, I think it was at 8 pounds, so like four kilos or something.
Okay, it was a lot for a rear wheel.
Yeah, it was pretty heavy. And it was quite funny. It didn't feel good, I'll say that much. Like, because I had to have the tire so hard and because it was so heavy, I had very little rear end grip. So when I was leaning into stuff, the back of the bike was just like drifting out. So it took me a little bit of time to get used to that. But once I got used to it, I just kind of dealt with it. There wasn't really any other option, to be honest. That you just, you know, you've just got to crack on. And yeah, I think I finished 10th in the last stage of the day. So that was quite a small victory at the end of it all, but it was
a tough weekend.
Yeah, character building, we'll say.
Yeah, for sure. Did you see someone on Pink Bike Forum, Mountain MTB Addict, wrote an entire song about it for you to the tune of I Will Survive by Gloria Gaynor, but renamed it I Will Survive?
Wow. Someone's got too much time on their hands.
You should check it out. It's pretty impressive.
I will.
Literally a whole song dedicated to that. So, yeah, go and have a look.
I'll check that out for sure.
Good stuff. So last time I saw you, you mentioned you've been having a go at the vegan thing. Mm. Are you still doing it or?
Part-time.
Okay, part-time vegan. Well, how did you get on with it?
It was pretty straightforward, to be honest. I decided to do November just to give it a go. Like, Mark's vegan and most of the guys I train with are vegan as well. So I thought I'd give it a go, and there's definitely something to it. It made me, I think if anything, more aware of what I was eating and not relying on meat or dairy or anything for like every meal. But yeah, I did November, and then I've kind of kept some aspects of it, but kind of gone back to eating meat, but I've eaten less meat and better quality, if you know what I mean. So I pretty much cut out dairy entirely. And yeah, it was definitely interesting. I mean, I was in good shape going into November, and I lost 3 kilos in a month. And my flatmate, who is still kind of keeping it up, he was 96 kilos, and now he's 83 since November.
That's insane.
So that's like 13 kilos in.
Yeah. And losing fat, but keeping the lean muscle still.
Yeah. Yeah. So I went down from like 74 kilos to 71, and then when I started, we started kind of a heavy block in the gym in December, and I started just eating eggs again and fish and kind of red meat once a week. And I've gone back up to 74, but kind of maintained that same lean mass, if you will.
Yeah.
But no, there's definitely something to it. Like when I did the month and I was at the, I'd say that the last week of it, and I was pretty light and lean, like I'd 100% noticed the difference in riding uphill, just carrying a little bit less weight. And you just feel, it's like every time you go out, you feel like your legs are good. And yeah, there's 100% something to it in my eyes. I don't know if it's totally the answer, but yeah, challenge people to try it. Like, try it for a month, see how you feel. It's yeah. if you can't do it, then
fair play. You're going to struggle you're going to struggle to take 3 kilos off your race bike, aren't you? So if you can take 3 kilos off yourself,
yeah, exactly. Like, I think it's a balance between being too light and being strong. Like, we need to be strong. And I like I said earlier, I discovered that last year with just how much I was kind of struggling on some of the longer, more physical stages. So you do need to be strong, but at the same time, you need to pedal at the top. So it's that balance of being lean and being light, but being strong also. And it's a difficult combination, but you know, I feel like we're pretty close.
Good stuff. Yeah, I'll have to give vegan a go. Definitely headed a bit more in that direction, but not quite there yet.
Yeah, it's a really really good book, actually. If anybody wants to try it, it's called Thug Kitchen.
Thug Kitchen, okay.
Yeah, it's lots of kind of easy to follow recipes, and they're all really tasty. Everyone I've made is really tasty. So one of my, Gaz Neal, one of the guys I train with, he bought it for me. And I try and make something out of it at least once a week. It definitely tests my cooking skills, but it's good.
Yeah, cool. We'll find a link for that and stick it in the show notes so people can find that if they want to have a look.
Cool.
And are you still riding your downhill bike very much?
Not a huge amount. I rode it on Saturday. When was that? Yeah, last week. So ended up doing an uplift day with Reese, which was quite funny. Because we spent so much time together on Junior, and I guess I kind of helped him a lot with bike setup early on. We can literally jump on each other's bikes and you didn't change much. So he'd kind of got his new bike, and I had my dyno bike and my trail bike, and was jumping between the two. But yeah, it was good, man. Like, I did a few runs on my dyno bike, then jumped on my trail bike, and then jumped on his dyno bike, and he jumped on my trail bike. And you know, you're just riding as fast as you would if it was your own bike, just because it's straight away. You know it's going to be set up pretty good. So yeah, there's not much I would change. I've taught him well.
Yeah, nice to have him back on the same team or same company at least.
I thought I'd seen the back of him, but. Can't get rid of them.
Oh, well, another year.
Yeah.
Cool. Good stuff. Well, we're getting close to the end of our time, but we've got our 3 questions that we've asked everyone. So we'll hit those up. The first of those is, if our listeners had £150 to spend to improve their performance on a bike, what would you recommend they spend it on?
Ooh. Probably a dirt school half day with myself.
Are you still coaching with them, yeah?
I still do a little bit. I actually don't really do any private stuff, just I'm so busy during the summer. But I think definitely some coaching, and there's a lot of good coaches out there, and I think just having somebody else look at your riding and seeing where you could improve and have things to work on is really beneficial. I think a lot of people get caught up in thinking that like carbon wheels are going to make them faster, and you're like, if your wheels are 100 grams lighter, then you will be marginally faster uphill, but you're not going to be a better rider because of it. You're just going to have a faster bike. So I think if people invested as much time in their own performance as they did their bike's performance, then they'd probably see bigger results.
Yeah. And are there like common mistakes that you see when you coach people? Are there a lot of people that are doing the same sort of things wrong?
Yeah, you see, it depends on the ability of the rider. Like, I'm quite fortunate that a lot of the riders I coach are already quite experienced and quite accomplished young racers. But I think in more like intermediate or novice riders, it's always the basics of kind of body position, and something nobody really talks about is balance. You know, the faster you go, the more control you have, because it's easier to balance at speed, right? If you're going 30 miles an hour down a hill on a road bike, it's pretty stable. Whereas if you go 5 miles an hour and you're just pottering along, it takes a lot more to balance. And being able to do that stood up rather than sitting down, understanding like the weight transfer between your feet. And, you know, I certainly, it's something I've worked on and worked on with other riders. And when you get to like a steep section of trail, or when you transfer that to a steep section of trail, should I say, you have the control kind of, because you can decide how fast you're going to ride it rather than just kind of getting to the top and pointing and shooting. As in, if you can ride it slowly because you've got that balance and that control, then it gives you, it's a much safer and more calculated way to ride it. Whereas if gravity is kind of deciding that for you, because you need to go a certain speed to keep your balance or your body position, then I think it's definitely something where you could work on some of the basics and you'd see improvements.
Okay. Are there certain kind of exercises on or off the bike you can do to improve that or to learn that?
It's quite funny, actually. With the work I've done with Dirt School and the base course in the Scottish Borders, we kind of almost discovered this by accident, but there was these log skinnies. So like your kind of typical North Shore that, you know, seems to have died a death on one of the climbs, and there would be like a foot off the ground. And the first one's kind of maybe 10 inches wide, and then it narrows to like 6 inches. And then the second one's like quite long and pretty narrow, like 5-6 inches. And riders would genuinely like avoid doing them because they didn't want to kind of be seen as, kind of having to ride off the log because they'd lost their balance. Yeah. And then myself and Andy Barrow, the coach at the time, were like, actually, we need to force them to do it, because they're avoiding it because they don't want to look stupid, rather than, you know, that it's too easy. Like, so we actually did a day where we were kind of talking through like trying to balance from your hips rather than your arms. Like, you'll see a lot of people will, when they lose balance, they'll kind of drop their elbow and lean with their upper body. And then if you lean with your upper body and your head, it's only going to pull your momentum one direction. Mm-hmm. As soon as you start leaning to the left and your head kind of goes outside your hips, you're going to tip over. It's only a matter of time before you actually lose balance and have to go that way. Whereas if you kind of do it through your hips and you use that to counterbalance each side, it gives you a lot more control. And yeah, it's just little things like that and kind of learning to balance. Like, a lot of people would do it sat down, and then because they can sit down, it gives them kind of stable contact patch in the middle of the bike, and then they can kind of use their knees to steer or to counterbalance. Whereas when you're riding downhill, you don't have that luxury of being sat down. As in, you have to, you know what I mean, you're on your two feet and your hands, and you have to work on balancing the bike through those kind of four contact points, if you will. So it might sound a bit complicated, but something for people to think about.
Yeah, it makes sense. And I generally avoid skinnies for the same reason, because I know I'm going to fall off them and look stupid. So I need to go practice that and use my hips.
Yeah.
Good stuff. All right, the next one. If you could wind back the clock and sit down with yourself at the age of 16, what advice would you give him?
Get a BMX. No, I think at 16 I was actually pretty, I was kind of doing pretty well. That's a difficult one. That's a difficult one. I think, get a hardtail and do more kind of dirt jumps or skate park or whatever. I think that's something that you know, like I said earlier, was probably one of the biggest, one of the things that I added to my training that I saw the biggest improvement in, and something I wish I'd done sooner. You know, when I spoke earlier about Josh and Brendan, and you know, it's no coincidence that those guys practically grew up riding hardtails and dirt jumps and whatever else, and that's transitioned into them being so skilled today. Like, it's, you know, just the sheer volume of time on the bike, and yeah, something I wish I'd maybe done a little bit earlier.
Yeah, and I guess a lot of younger riders these days as well, like, they progress to a full sus bike pretty quickly because there's more around, they're more affordable maybe. So people are missing out on that learning, I suppose, from a harder to ride or less forgiving bike.
Yeah, I think as at the same time though, with the amount of pump tracks we have being built, and the, you know, 10 years ago they were pretty much unheard of, and you know, now it seems like there's a new one being built nearly everywhere, and I think that's really good. And if anything is even more mountain bike specific than a skate park is, and it's the same thing, like, you know, timing and jumps and manuals and berms, and it's, you know, the perfect environment to develop skills. And yeah, I think it's definitely given the next generation of riders a kind of a helping hand, and you know, I see it in the younger generation, even locally, like how far ahead skill wise they are in comparison to where I was when I was kind of that age. So it's cool to see.
Yeah, the sport's progressing pretty quick. And then the last question, if you could have a coaching session from anybody, who would you choose and what would you want to learn from them?
That's a tough one. I reckon it would be like a professional chef and get a cooking lesson. Someone like Gordon Ramsay, just go and get a lesson from him and just be taught some skills in the kitchen. And yeah, you know, he's got pretty good chat. Probably swears as much as me, so
I think it'd be good fun.
Yeah, he's Scottish as well, so we'd get along fine.
There you go, perfect. Send him a direct message on Instagram and I'm sure he'll be up for it.
Yeah, well, I'll think about that one.
Cool. And if people want to check you out on social media and stuff and follow your adventures, where's the best place to find you?
I think social media is just Instagram these days, so at @RC_MTB on Instagram. All right. And I'm a bit slack with it, to be honest, but when I actually do some riding in some nice places, I'll post more photos.
Excellent, good stuff. We'll look forward to it. Yeah, we'll stick a link to that in the show notes as well. Cool. Perfect. Right, well, thank you very much. Cheers for taking some time out of your evening. It's been fun chatting, and we wish you all the best for 2019 and look forward to seeing how you get on.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
All right, that's it for this week's episode. I hope you've enjoyed listening. I know I certainly enjoyed chatting with Rory. Don't forget to check out what our supporting partners 661 and the Strength Factory have to offer. All the links are on the episode page over on our website, downtimepodcast.com. Don't forget to give us a follow on social media, subscribe to the podcast. I promise it will make your life easier and it's free. And also keep letting your friends know about the podcast. Right, we've got another awesome episode coming up soon. But until then, get out and ride.